When hiking alone in my 25th year in the southwestern barrens of Newfoundland Interior Highlands, I found myself lost for 3 days, in which events took place that disturbed me in ways I thought not possible. In those 72 hours, I wandered aimlessly but not without purpose into what I can only describe as some sort of grand hallucination or a waking fever dream. And the thought of those days in the lost wilderness brings me to tears now as I type these long repressed words which have plagued me for a lifetime. Forgive my ramblings and my endlessly meandering mind and my thoughts which run too long and too wildly, and remember, please, that those same unending images plague me in a way that you could never begin to imagine. Forgive me, reader, as I try to describe the agony that I'd endured in those days and throughout the sleepless nights since those steps I took into the world best left undisturbed. A long weekend on holiday from the teaching college seemed to me the perfect opportunity to rediscover places I'd visited in my youth with my uncle, my mother's brother, who'd trapped foxes and beavers and mink and the elusive Arctic hares which used to run like lightning through those lands. He'd taken me on camping trips into the barrens where we walked and talked and fished for trout in cold little pools and sat around small fires brewing tea in apple juice cans. He would tell me stories of his people, the Mi'kmaq, and how they would hunt herds of woodland and caribou that ran thick as sheep through the unyielding country in the days before the white men and the moose and the coyote came. He'd tell me of the Beothuk, who were all now dead and gone to the last, and whose paths his elders had once shown to him. The same paths they used to tread on their annual migrations from the country to the shores of the sea and beyond. And he told me, if my memory is worth trusting after all these years, of the people that had lived there even before those native folk, whose language and paths and territories and legends and gods were witnessed only by the dead ancestors of our dead ancestors, and of whom there was no living memory other than the rumor that they'd once lived in that land. He shared with me the subtle and minimalistic clues of their heritage that he had gathered from his elders, but much of it was unknown to him even in those days, because he'd been forced into learning by missionaries under the name of the Catholic Church at a young age, and they'd schooled him in English and forbade the uttering of his mother tongue. From what I was able to gather from him before he passed away in his 40s is not enough to fully describe the culture of those people. None of their language or customs were known to him, and of their origins he would simply state that they were of that place. Not that they had originated there, but they had always just been there. He didn't know what had happened to them, nor did anyone that he had ever spoken to. It seems to me now that the truest explanation of those people is that they once were there, but now they're not. And any pondering as to why this is the case is so far removed from the time of those folks that it became an irrelevant question. Of their territory, he was very specific, and from this I gather that they were not a people of great number, possibly existing in one large community or tribe due to a reliance on a localized resource which was in great supply in the region, or perhaps it was the locale of their last stand against some greater outside threat that was beyond their understanding or comprehension, and against which they resisted desperately until the speakers of legends forgot that they'd ever occupied a place that was not this one. According to my uncle, it was within the barrens that they lived, and it is this area which remains in its state of undeveloped wilderness as I write this sentence. It was because of this mystery that I was drawn to that region as a child, and I would daydream endlessly about hiking across the expanse in search of some evidence of those people. Perhaps the remains of a settlement or a burial site. I wanted desperately to know what had happened to them, who they were, what their relationship with their land was. However, my uncle would always follow the same few paths on our hikes into that country, and if I were ever to implore about some far-off location beyond the regular areas explored, he'd sternly redirect my attention to the current path and express a sometimes extreme anger toward my tendency to stray. Despite his urging and constant arguments about the dangers of being lost in the barrens, my eyes and my thoughts wandered always toward the horizon and the turns not taken. Finally, this inherent curiosity led me to set foot again into that vast and lonesome place, taking with me a small pack of provisions and a tent to set up in case of rain. It was my plan to set course from the stretch of highway near the Middle Ridge Wilderness Reserve near Baie des Sports and trek due west. I would end my hike on the highway near the Aniopsquatch Mountains and hitch a ride to the nearest bus terminal. I set out on the 11th of October at dawn, with the sun at my back and the retreating night ahead of me, and grinning to myself as each step brought me further and farther down the inevitable route that would lead to the rest of my life. The first day was difficult. It took time for my body to adjust to the task at hand. 2 years of studying at a desk were not the best preparation for my chosen route, which would take at least 4 days to traverse. But I forced myself onward, draining my water canteen every few hours. At last, I reached the point of no return, where the last visible signs of human civilization would dip below the horizon. I stopped there, filled my canteen at a small stream, and looked around at the vast and deeply blue sky and felt, for the first time in years, a sense of just how small I was within this wide and ancient land. I turned for a last look toward the highway in the east, and then continued to walk. In the middle of the afternoon, I crossed through the remains of a forest that had burned long ago, where bleach-white bones of limbless tree husks stood in stark contrast against the rusty berry bushes that covered the high ground in that time of year. Later, I stumbled on the remains of a campsite, the occupants of which had left dozens of shattered beer bottles strewn across the ground in a wide arc around their fire, as though they'd been betting who could throw it the farthest. That night, I slept beneath the stars in a dry hollow between dwarf fir trees and watched the stars flickering overhead in the inky blackness. I had never felt so alive. The second day, I woke with a start as the little stunted trees around me shook with a thundering of footsteps, and I stood up to find my camp surrounded by a small herd of migrating caribou. There were about 50. And they moved steadily eastward, chewing at the ground and puffing steam from their long muzzles, and they had soon passed me by, heading into the sunrise. That day I walked slowly, because of the muscles cramping in my legs, but in a few hours I'd found my pace again and moved steadily westward into that place, opposite to the journey of the caribou. The land began to change as I carried on, with the springy semi-tundra hardening into a dry and unforgiving soil that resisted any pressure, and if I closed my eyes, I could almost convince myself I was walking on asphalt. By noon, I came to the edge of a wide valley, carved by glaciers and millennia of erosion into a sloping bowl that stretched nearly to the horizon on the other side. There was a river flowing through it, and I decided that I would rest there. It took until late afternoon for me to come to the river, and when I did, I was more tired than I could ever remember. My feet were blistered, my shoulders aching from my pack, the smell of sweat in my clothes was so strong that I stripped naked and wrung them out in the cold, clear water. I began to think then that my trip was not as well planned as I had thought. I had only just enough food for 3 days, although I was sure I'd packed more and I hadn't brought a change of clothes because I thought I would save space. My mood turned sour, and I stared angrily at the valley wall before me and made the hasty choice to climb it before setting camp. It'd be dark by 7, but I didn't care. I was so fed up with myself that I just wanted to get the hike over with as fast as possible. I didn't dare turn back, because if my friends at the college got word that I'd forfeited my great adventure, they'd never let me hear it out. And despite my bad temper and my sudden impatience, I still longed to see the expanse in its entirety. I marched up the hillside faster than was wise, through the thinning trees and over rocks and under arm-like scooping branches and around another large herd of caribou that followed toward the river in a flood of fur and antlers. The hours flew by, and still I climbed on in my stupidity, and it was well after sunset when I stumbled blindly onto the crest of a small hill at the valley's edge and set camp for the night. I ate ravenously, and laughed at my own stubbornness, and lay in my sleeping roll watching the flames before quickly falling into a deep and exhausted sleep. I woke in the night to my little fire dying into feeble, smoldering coals, and struggled out of my sleeping roll, fighting to keep from shuddering in the unbelievably cold air. The temperature had dropped unexpectedly, and the frost was gathering in the tips of the surrounding vegetation, glowing in the soft blue light cast down by the moon, which was waning, but as if yet bright enough to illuminate my campsite. My hands were numb, and after struggling to get the fire going again, I gave up and fumbled in my pack for the tent. In the minutes it took to set up, I found myself jumping at small sounds and turning quickly to look over my shoulder. The silence of the hill at night was staggering. In each movement I made to adjust the tent straps or strap down a peg or throw my belongings inside, it brought an unbearable sensation down upon me as though I'd give myself away. But to who? At last, I erected the tiny shelter, pulled myself inside of it head first, and wrapped myself in my sleeping roll to settle once again into a peaceful sleep. It was at this point I realized I'd forgotten to tie the tent flap shut. Being as tired as I was, I decided that a small draft would be tolerable, and I tucked myself in doubly against the cold with only my head protruding. I lay there for a while, listening to the sounds of the barrens outside, of the persistent fall breeze rustling against the canvas, of the last few coals sputtering out in the cold, of the movement of the caribou in the valley below, grunting in the dark. And the night drew on, and I lay there, breathing quietly and watching my breath turn into a moist fog that hung in the tent like the smoke of a doused candle. I listened with increasing intensity to the minute sounds of the world outside, which seemed to be growing more and more sparse as the moments passed. The winds became gentler and less chaotic, and after a time they ceased completely, and the air hung heavily over the world. In that stillness and absolute silence came the suspicion that there was something moving nearby, outside my little canvas tent. I did not see a shadow cast by the moon against the thin and tightly bound fabric, nor did I hear a noise that would give away to the approach of an entity into my small camp. I felt, in that void of sound and light which surrounded me entirely, a change in the air of which I cannot accurately explain. The very night itself seemed to be drawing in on me, pressing itself into my skin and bruising obscenely against the space near the back of my neck and shoulders, as if to suggest the presence of some invisible form that had wandered unwelcomed into that place and passed through it without noticing my huddled form laying crumpled in fear across its path. I held myself still, reducing my breaths to shallow murmurs, and fought against the hollow pain raising in my stomach. And when the sound of my own low gasp for air became unbearably distracting, I took in a lungful and held it, waiting against hope as cold, stinging sweat oozed into my eyes. I used the last of my faltering willpower to resist the urge to blink and focus the entirety of my attention on the narrow window left by the unfastened flap of canvas hanging above my feet. I waited. In all of that vast and empty nothingness out there, I could plainly see some pale thing run past the open end of my tent. I gasped for air, unable to stop my body from emitting a small shriek of fear. I lurched forward, plunging my head out through the tent flap and into the night. I stared all around, scanning the hillside for as far as I could see, but there was nothing there. Slowly, quietly, I backed into the tent and tied the flap tightly shut and buried myself in my sleeping roll, curling into a shaking ball with my knees and my chest, and covered myself entirely. I was still laying in that position, still shivering, still drenched in a sticky, waxy sweat, when I lifted my face from under the blanket to realize that the sun was starting to rise. I exited the tent, slowly at first, and then springing wildly around, darting left and right, hoping to confuse any intruder that may be watching and waiting for a chance for a surprise attack. But there was only me alone on that hill. I stuffed my tent hastily into my bag and gathered my few possessions and noticed with a sideways glance that my fire coals were still smoking hot as I turned to leave camp, despite the fire having gone out hours ago. With the morning sun warming my back, I started to regain some of my nerve, and within an hour, I was convincing myself that what I'd seen could be nothing more than a lone animal passing by. Perhaps it was a straggler caribou from the herd in the valley, and perhaps my heightened senses during that moment were a symptom of my being alone for nearly 3 days. I told myself, out loud, as though to an audience. There was nothing to be afraid of. Now, I figured, I ought to be at the halfway point of my hike, but as I examined my small and tattered map, I realized that I must have walked slightly off course, either to the north or the south. None of the landmarks that I'd expected to see from the map were visible, and the wide valley that I'd crossed the previous day didn't seem to show up at all on the paper. I was lost. But what kept me from panicking was that I knew if I kept walking westward, I'd eventually reach the highway, as long as I kept my head straight and didn't start going in circles. It would have been possible for me to turn back the way I'd come. But something kept me going onward, deeper into those barrens, and away from the valley I'd crossed. Here, the landscape had undergone another transition, and where before there were long stretches of rolling hills, now the rises lay low against the earth, and I felt as though I could see an impossible distance in each direction. The graceful topography of the valley had given way to an endless stony plain scattered with enormous erratic boulders that rose as high as houses and rested uneasily on points that suggested they might topple, given the slightest amount of pressure. Upon their surfaces were carved crude forms like the dashes of some lost runic language, or perhaps the shapes of animals worn away beyond recognition. Upon closer inspection, I decided they must have been the weathered markings of windblown sand, nothing more. It made the most sense. The vegetation was reduced to scattered wiry bushes, the reddish brown of clotted blood, and the lichen grew thick upon the ground. I walked and shuddered at the bizarre echoing of my own footsteps off those stone giants, and did not stop to rest until the moon overtook the sun in the evening sky. I wasted no time with fires that night. Immediately, I set my tent on a growth of green lichen and climbed inside, fastening myself and my few belongings securely within the confines of those canvas walls, and wrapped myself tightly in a blanket. Reaching into my pack, I found my rations gone, lost through a rip in the fabric. Only my water canteen and a few curious stones remained. I shut my eyes and prayed for sleep, as I'd only gotten a few hours since my first camp. I wanted desperately to feel the embrace of unconsciousness and for the aching in my muscles and stomach to subside. Even a nightmare would be better than this. But sleep did not come. And in the minutes that followed, I fell again into that deep sense of dread that I'd experienced the night before on the hilltop. A deathly quiet had formed around me, and the sounds of my own body seemed immeasurably loud. I struggled to keep my entire body hidden inside the sleeping roll. It was slightly too small. My feet, or the top of my head, or my back kept protruding into the cold air of the tent in those moments. I shuddered and frantically worked to conceal myself again. I knew that nothing could see me inside the tent, but it didn't matter. I started to wonder if I'd left the flap open again, and too frightened to check and see, I remained in my blanket cocoon, awaiting morning or some terrible end to the silence. From outside the tent, there came a faint rustling noise. I held my breath again, focusing entirely on remaining still and listening, but there was no need. The sound grew louder. It became clear to me that there was somebody or something nearby, and that they were not alone. The rustling grew louder still, and there was a shifting and scraping of something soft against the stony floor of the night, and then a grinding noise like the crunching of dry gravel beneath a wheel. I grabbed my forearm and pinched hard, hoping to wake myself from the dream, digging in my fingernails and drawing blood. I did not wake. I wasn't asleep. Slowly, with a movement I was sure wouldn't make a sound, I pulled the blanket down over my face and forced open my eyes. Outside, there was the unmistakable flickering light of a fire, and it flashed and cast silhouettes of grotesque forms which licked and rippled across the canvas, and I could not bring myself to look away. They were the, like, naked shapes of men or women with their unclothed bodies bared against the night and prancing fluidly by the movement of the flame in their own otherworldly dance. and their long, distorted forms wound themselves around me in a tiny, cold bed and sucked the breath from my body as they lifted their arms to the night and sang in a tongue that seemed to not come from their mouths but from the very earth itself and sounded to me like nothing, like speech at all. And they were not men or women. From their bodies, there came impossible shapes like antlers or tails or branches of trees or the billowing of clouds or the glistening forms of some rotting thing that had once been alive. They swayed with the fire, enchanted and transformed, and they'd heard the screams of terror bursting from my own shapeless mouth and approached the tent, and then I knew there was no hope, and my eyes filled with sweat and tears and blinded me so I did not see their faces when they came and dragged me away into the horror that waited out there in that cruel and loathsome night. I woke in the morning, frost in my hair. My tent and my pack were gone, and around me in a perfect circle lay the remains of burnt wood and coals and bones blackened from roasting. I rose and stared around me, my eyes darting from one boulder to the next, expecting to see one of my attackers out there watching me. But there was nothing. I walked in a circle, jumping and clapping hard in an attempt to bring life back to my numb and feet and hands. My boots had been taken as well, and all the while staring around in the dim early light. On the ground there was a chunk of burned meat. And with a full day and night's worth of hunger gnawing at me, I picked it up and sunk my teeth into it, hardly chewing before swallowing and tearing off another bite. On the outside, the meat was black and hard, but inside the crust, it was still red raw, and warm blood dripped down my chin and soaked my clothes, and it seemed to tense up when I sunk my teeth as though the muscle were still alive. I couldn't stop. I gorged on the strange flesh, and when it was gone, I licked my hands and sat on the ground, staring up at the orange and violet sky, and broke into sobs of joy, or relief, or despair. I can't say which one it was for sure. And I started to walk again, my back to the sun. After a time, there came the sounds of claws or hooves on the ground, but I did not turn back to look. I kept walking westward, even when the great stones on either side began to creak and groan as though they'd fall and crush my body into nothingness. I did not stop when the chant began in my wake, and the sky became choked with the clouds, and the air grew hot and moist like the cavity of a freshly dead corpse. The smell of meat was in my throat, and I gagged and fell to my knees, but my retching brought up only ash and bile, so I got to my feet again. Sounds of the dancing, chanting things followed me in my hysteria throughout the day and the night that followed. Out of the hard plain and over fields of yellow grass and through the stinking bog where my bleeding soles turned the water red. I dared not turn to face them until the next day after I had passed between two toppled mounds of stone that perhaps once had been placed by hand, and it was in that moment when I finally looked behind me and saw there was nothing there. Sometimes I think that was worse than everything that had happened before. By noon, I'd given up and toppled face down onto the ground and lay there waiting to die. I wanted to die. I did not shudder when I heard footsteps approaching, or when the shouting started, or when the hands closed tightly around my shoulders, turning me onto my back so all I could see was the blinding white light of the sun in my eyes. It was a hunter, staring down at me, shaking me with a look on his face that told me he thought I was dead. He half-dragged, half-carried me to the roadside, just over a kilometer away, and helped me into the back of his truck, where I lost myself in a fit of tears and screaming, and insisted that it couldn't be real. He drove me to the hospital, urging that I have food and water he pushed into my face, and I thanked him, even though I was too tired to eat. I never told the doctors what I'd seen, because I know they would have surely had me locked away, and perhaps they would have been right to. Perhaps the medication they would have prescribed me might have helped with the nightmares and the hallucinations I've had since then, but I've always been too afraid to let them examine me. Maybe they'd make the horrors go away and make me see the nonsense of my fears. Maybe they'd prove my memories to be false, imaginings. But if they didn't, I tell myself that those visions I experienced were figments of my fevered mind brought up by some long-past trauma in my own youth, and that whatever had occurred in those barrens years ago was lost in time. The dead are gone, and the past is the past. But is that the truth? In those spaces, uninhabited for countless years, is there not something lingering of the place that had once been, or of the ones who had lived there? Could there, perhaps, in some long-forgotten corner of those endless barrens, remain the memory of what had existed there before our time, like the decay of a shout or a cry or a laughter that rings on and on, but grows increasingly distant and distorted? Could it be that a shadow remains hidden away of the life that had been? Those voices that had spoken in tongues unknown may still be ringing, echoing faintly the response of the land to the human voice, or some other voice that had made a sound. Some wisp of thought may still linger in the roots of grasses over the hollows of ancient trees, or the dusty, hard spaces between the ground and flattened stones which wait with inconceivable patience to be kicked aside by the toes of some restless intruder who knows not where he walks. And if he stops abruptly and listens, with a sudden, vivid sense of his loneliness and the pulsing in his chest and the breath of hot wind against the back of his ragged scalp and twists around in his sweaty clothes and holds his breath in his throat in a moment of painful and terrible anticipation. Does he hear it? I'd rather believe I'm insane. The small orb of orange light quickly illuminated, then faded back into the darkness, as Paul Donovan took a draw from his cigarette. He sat slouched in a plush chair in his living room, the hand that held the cigarette now dangling over the armrest. When he exhaled, the smoke rose and hovered near the ceiling, though it was impossible to see it in the darkness. After a brief moment of questioning his willingness to continue, he picked up the TV remote in his free hand and pressed the power button. The solid blue screen initially caused his dilated pupils to ache, so much so that he winced and glanced away from the screen for a few seconds. Once his eyes adjusted, Paul swapped the TV remote for his wireless game controller. He pressed and held the start button until the system booted up. After taking one final draw of a cigarette, he snuffed it out in an ashtray that was resting on a nearby end table. The disc reader inside his console whirred as it spun up to load the game data. Continue to level 3. The dialogue box gave him one last chance to change his mind. He initially used the controller stick to highlight the no response and lingered there while contemplating the possible consequences of playing on. But he had to finish what he'd started. And he hoped by that completing the game he could put an end to this madness. More importantly, he wanted his son back, and he was prepared to do whatever was necessary in order to get him home safely. He returned the cursor to the yes option and confirmed his choice. Being an avid lover of horror and survival games, it was only natural that Paul would accept the challenge to play this game. He learned of it quite by accident 2 weeks ago as he was browsing the discussion forum of his favorite gaming site. Someone had posted a topic requesting recommendations for the scariest games. Paul opened the thread with the intention of providing a long list of his favorites, but as he read through the responses, he saw the conversation had turned into a much different direction, beginning with a reply from a user he'd never seen before. If you guys are looking for a scary game, I've got one for you. I'll bet no one on this board can even finish it. Yeah, right. We've played everything there is. What's the name of it then, newbie? This dude's got a low post count and an outrageous claim. The guy's obviously a troll. Well, what game is it? Let me guess. A Pokemon game? Ugh, dude, this guy's a troll. Come on, guys. Don't feed him. It's called Willow Creek. Yeah, that sounds lame. I googled your little game. It doesn't exist. Nice try, though. Bye-bye now. It's a pre-production bootleg. It's not supposed to be out till next year. We still would have heard of it as an upcoming release. Beside that, how would you even know how to get a hold of such a thing? Some people. I work for the developer. That's all I can say. Do you want to play it or not? What system is it on? DM me. I'll get you the version for whatever system you need. The more Paul read into the depth of the thread, the more his interest was piqued. He wondered whether or not Raven had gone on to request the game from the stranger. He hovered his mouse over the link to Chameleon's profile, then clicked it and began composing his own private message to the unknown user. He was hesitant at first to give out his home address, but he rationalized it away by telling himself that it wasn't any different than hundreds of random strangers using eBay that had already obtained his personal information over the years. A yellow, padded envelope with no return address arrived in Paul's mailbox 4 days after he sent the private message. Inside was the game disc and a paper sleeve. On this disc, crudely written in ink, was Willow Creek, Beta Version 1.0. So this chameleon guy is in charge of beta testing. That makes a little more sense, Paul mumbled to himself. His mouth then broadened into a partial smile. I don't have to be so cryptic about it. A young boy came running into the kitchen where Paul stood looking over the rest of the mail. Who are you talking to, Dad? The boy asked. That's no one, Scotty, just myself. He shuffled through the bills and the junk mail. Scotty was 10 years old, an above-average student, but a typical boy all around. He loved playing the seemingly endless stream of video games that his father was constantly bringing home. They'd partnered up for many adventures on most of the multiplayer games, unless Paul deemed the game to be too mature for Scotty. And even when the games were single-player, Scotty loved to watch as his father solved all the puzzles and defeated the toughest bosses. Paul knew that Scotty's mother would probably not approve of all the games that they'd played together, but she hadn't had a say in the matter for nearly a year now. "We got a new game," Paul announced to his son, holding the disc out toward Scotty. Scotty took it from him. "It looks fake," he said. "Well, it's a beta test. We'll be among the first players." Scotty's eyes lit up. "Cool. Can we play it tonight?" "Sure, if we have time. Make sure you get all your homework done first, though, okay?" Scotty hung his head as he placed the game disc on the kitchen table. "All right," he replied in a resigned voice, remembering how much homework awaited him that evening. It was getting late when Scotty finally finished his schoolwork and came barreling into the living room, begging his father to play the new game. "It's already 9:30, bud. You need to be going to bed soon." "Can we at least start it?" Paul hesitated for a moment. "Okay, but you're not staying up past 10. Scotty's excitement boiled over as he grabbed the game disc and booted up the console. He handed his father the first player controller, and after a brief title screen, there were 3 level options listed from top to bottom. The only option that was active was level 1. The remaining 2 levels were grayed out. In the background behind the text was the still image of a closed door, depicted from inside a dark room with light radiating from the gaps at its edges. "What's this about?" Scotty asked. "I don't know exactly, but it's supposed to be scary, so I may be sending you to bed if it gets too bad." Scotty groaned. Paul confirmed the selection of level 1 and sat back as the game loaded. "Looks like it's only 1 player. You'll just have to watch me play for a while." "That's okay." After a few seconds of load time, a cutscene appeared. Paul and his son watched the animated footage, a first-person perspective as the protagonist entered a door with a frosted glass window into an antiquated office environment. On the window, decaled in thick black lettering, was Detective Charleston. Somber, ambient music droned on in the background. The scene reminded Paul the way many of the classic film noirs he'd seen over the years had begun. Right away, he realized that this would be more of a puzzle-solving game, an intellectual's game. Paul caught on to the gist of the game relatively quickly. He played as Detective Charleston, traveling all around the virtual town of Willow Creek and finding clues that could be pieced together to advance the storyline. In Level 1's Mystery, he was introduced to the story of James Braxton, a man that worked the third shift at Willow Creek Steel Mill. One night, while having an argument with a coworker, James was pushed into the blast furnace. The perpetrator left the scene, and there were no other witnesses. It was up to Paul to find all of the evidence and have the murderer convicted. During one particularly realistic cutscene of the murder, Paul ordered Scotty off to bed. Scotty protested at first, but soon relented. Paul finished solving the case by himself and was pleased with his work when the police finally slapped the handcuffs on the murderer in the final cutscene of Level 1. The game automatically saved his progress. Paul's phone rang. He looked at his watch. 12:37. Oh, come on, you're going to wake up Scotty, he whispered as he reached for the phone and answered it. Hello? Thank you for setting me free. Paul pulled the phone away from his ear to glance at the screen. Unknown caller. Who is this? James Braxton. Who? James, from Willow Creek, you solved my case. Paul was taken aback. He glanced at the television screen, which now displayed a dialogue box beaconing, continue to Level 2. Who is this, really? And where did you get my number? I told you, I'm James from Willow Creek. I just wanted to thank you for solving my case. Now I'm free. Only had about 6 weeks left before reaching the dreaded 1 year mark. Thank God you came along. No one else has solved my case yet. Where did you get my number? Paul interrupted. From Chameleon, of course. Paul trailed off as the phone slipped from his hand and landed with a thud on the carpet. His mouth slacked open in disbelief. He looked down at the phone. The illuminated screen stared back up at him. He could still hear the muffled voice at the other end. He grabbed the phone and shut it off as quickly as he could. Paul's heart was racing, and drops of sweat began to form on his brow as he switched off the game console and the TV set. He was bathed in silence and in the darkness of his living room. After a long moment to gather his thoughts and allow his pulse to settle, he quietly snuck into Scotty's room where he watched his son sleep peacefully for several minutes. Paul was not able to fall asleep himself until nearly 4 a.m. He couldn't shake the uneasy feeling of the phone call. His last thought before finally drifting off into slumber was how useless he was going to be at work later that day. Paul awoke in a fog at first, but then jolted upright when he saw the time on his bedside clock. 10:23. The room was washed in dim shades of gray as a heavy rain beat steadily at the roof and windows. Apparently Paul had forgotten to set his alarm amidst the chaos that followed his completion of Level 1. After the utterance of a few choice profanities and throwing off the bedsheets, he darted into Scotty's room. His empty bed was neatly made, and in the kitchen Paul found the note. You were sleeping so well, I made my own breakfast. I have to catch the bus soon. Love, Scotty. Paul sighed and felt like such a failure as a father. It was in moments like these that he'd wished Laura was still there. He missed her in so many ways, and her penchant for organization, though annoying at times, was something he undeniably needed in his life. Paul stared into the blank space as he relived in his mind the accident that took her. Once he snapped out of the vision, he decided to call in sick to work. Afraid to turn on his cell phone, he made the call from his landline. After a quick breakfast, Paul debated with himself about whether or not to continue the game. He finished off a cigarette as he rehearsed the events of the previous night. As unnerving as it had been for him at the time, it now seemed nothing like more than a strange coincidence with the wrong number. A very strange coincidence, but how else could it be explained? Besides, Paul was never one to back away from a challenge. He had to finish the game. The console booted up, the disc spun, and the title screen gave way to the dialogue box. Continue to Level 2? Paul confirmed the yes selection. The second case for Detective Charleston was that of a housing developer who had dug up human remains while leveling a lot for construction. The site of the discovery was roped off, and it was the objective of the player to properly collect all the evidence and determine who the remains belonged to and what had happened to them. Paul was meticulous in his actions and was careful to think of every possible piece of evidence. He collected samples for DNA testing. He interviewed the former landowner, the construction foreman, and the equipment operator who had made the discovery. He pored over photographs of the crime scene. Little by little, he pieced together the story of a woman that had been kidnapped and murdered. She'd been carjacked, and a fiery accident was staged to cover up the disappearance. She was then held captive by her abductor until he finally did away with her and buried her remains. The case was solved in its entirety when the DNA test results came back. There were two DNA profiles in the samples, one for the perpetrator, who turned out to be a known troublemaker in Willow Creek, and the other for the victim, Laura Donovan. Paul threw the controller aside. His pulse immediately increased to the point that he could feel his neck throbbing. His ears began shaking. There's no way. He choked on the words. Tears welled up in his eyes as he recalled the circumstances surrounding Laura's death. The car had burned beyond recognition. The funeral was a closed casket. Had something more happened to her? Had she not died at the scene as the game was suggesting? What are you? He screamed at the television, his face dark red. There was no answer, just the ever-increasing throbbing of his pulse, now audible in his ears, and the prompt on the screen. Continue to level 3. Paul rushed over and unplugged the game system. The TV screen shone a solid blue. With the exception of the pounding rain outside, silence enveloped the house. He paced around the living room, wrestling in his own mind for answers. How was this possible? There's no way it was all a coincidence. The wall phone rang. The sound of the mechanical bell was jolting, threatening to split Paul's head in two. He agonized at the thought of the caller's identity. Most people did not have his home phone number. No, please, no, don't do this to me. His initial reaction was one of terror, but what if it really was Laura calling? What if he'd somehow released her from the clutches of the game, just as James claimed that he'd done in his case? It was ridiculous, Paul thought. She's dead. He made his way over to the phone, mounted on the kitchen wall. Hello? Paul said with great caution, the way an intimidated child would approach an angry parent. Paul Donovan? It was a woman's voice. Yes. This is Janice Pendleton from Roosevelt Elementary School. We're calling to check on your son, Scotty, since he was absent today. Paul was at a loss for words. Janice continued. We couldn't reach you on your cell phone, but we found this alternate number in Scotty's file. You're telling me he didn't show up today? There was a pause of confusion before Janice delicately replied. Yes, sir. We found it odd since he rarely misses days, so we wanted to check. She trailed off. He left for school as usual this morning, Paul said. I was sleeping, but... He realized that no matter what he said next would make him sound like a negligent parent. He began to weep and tried his best to hide this from Janice, but she was able to pick up on it. Mr. Donovan, if you're saying you don't know where he is either, do you want us to notify the authorities? No longer attempting to hide his sobbing, he managed to blurt out, Yes, please. And then wept uncontrollably, dropping the phone receiver. It hit the kitchen wall with a hard thud and swung there by its cord as Paul sank to the floor. Paul spent the remainder of the afternoon and evening at the police station. He answered a barrage of questions from multiple officers and detectives. He filled out endless amounts of paperwork. He pleaded with everyone he encountered to stop wasting time and to find his son. The officers convinced Paul that they would do everything in their power and then persuaded him to go home in case Scotty returned. That's how many of these cases resolve themselves in the early stages, one officer told him. The rain had subsided by the time Paul returned home, leaving wet streaks and walkways. He unlocked his front door and entered the darkness. The house was silent.
Scotty?
He called, standing in the doorway.
You there?
There was no response. Paul knew that if he were to simply sit around the house waiting, he would go insane. So he booted up his computer to revisit the message board about the game. And to give this chameleon guy a piece of his mind. As the computer was starting up, he gazed at a framed photo on the desktop. The picture was of himself, Laura, and Scotty, taken at a family reunion during a much happier time in their lives. He fought tears again, and then turned the photo face down on the desk. The computer was ready. He navigated the message board and found the thread. He noticed two things that had happened since he'd last been there. First, the user Chameleon01 no longer was listed. Everywhere he'd posted as a username was replaced by an icon with a text that said, "No longer a registered user." The other item of interest was that the thread had been locked by the moderators after the argument about the mysterious game grew much more intense. As Paul was reading the heated exchange, he heard the front door open. A sigh of relief washed over him and an impossibly large smile crossed his face.
Scotty!
He yelled and ran down the hallway.
Scotty, you're home! Thank God you had me
Paul stopped, dead in his tracks when he turned the corner to face the front door. Scotty had not come home. But Laura had. Even though she'd lost weight and appeared sickly, Laura's embrace felt like home. He was comfortable, familiar, although it had been almost a year since Paul had experienced it. They lingered in the doorway in that position before either of them spoke. Finally, Paul pulled back his hands, remaining on her shoulders, and asked, "Laura, is it really you? How is this possible?"
"It's really me. You freed me. It's so good to be home."
Paul was awestruck as they resumed the embrace. They kissed passionately for several minutes. Once the disbelief of her presence lessened, Paul led Laura over to the couch to question her about all that happened.
"I don't even know where to start, Laura. I was playing this video game and I know, Paul, I know. Let me tell you everything that happened to me."
Paul nodded and listened intently.
"I didn't die in the car crash," Laura began. "He took me."
"Who took you?"
"This thing that calls himself the Chameleon."
Paul's stomach sank and his brow creased as he tried to make sense of this.
"Took you where exactly?" "After he abducted me and burned my car, I woke up in a holding cell. There were hundreds of us in there, stacked in cages, lining the walls. I don't think this place is even in this realm. He told us that if someone solved our case in the game, he'd send us back to the real world. And when I was released, I passed through some sort of portal and wound up in the sewer tunnels under Hamilton Square."
"What the hell? That sounds crazy, Laura."
"I know it does, Paul, but you've got to believe me. It's happening."
"But what is he getting out of this? I mean, why not just make a game without the human collateral?"
"I think the human collateral is the point. It's some kind of sick game to him. The cages are stacked around the perimeter of a very large warehouse-like room. In the center of the room is a stage where people whose cases aren't solved within 1 year are creatively..." She began crying. "Dispatched in gruesome ways."
Laura leaned over to embrace Paul again, her tears dampening his shoulder.
"I saw terrible things, Paul. And my time on the stage was only 2 weeks away.
the gravity of this hit Paul like a ton of bricks. He rubbed her back.
You saved me, Paul. Thank you.
I have to tell you something, Laura, he said after a contemplative pause. Scotty's missing.
I know,
Laura replied somberly.
He's in the game.
Paul sat in the dark living room and stared at the prompt on the screen. Continue to level 3. After selecting yes, and while waiting for the case to load, he closed his eyes and hoped beyond measure that the case he would be presented with was Scotty's. Laura watched silently from the couch. The familiar cutscene played, showing the entrance into Detective Charleston's office. Once Paul had control of the game, he opened the last case file and began reading. It must update through the internet connection, Paul said to Laura. The disk is just a gateway into the game. I'll bet if we went back to level 1 again, it would not be James' case, but something new. One of Chameleon's latest victims. As Paul was saying this, he had the sudden realization that this would never end. He'd be compelled from then on to spend every waking moment of his life playing this game, lest someone experience a gruesome death that he might have been able to prevent. His conscience would never let him put it down. Paul refocused on the task at hand. He worked the level 3 case as diligently as he knew how, talking to possible witnesses in Willow Creek and collecting evidence from the playground where the boy was last seen. Soon he was at an impasse. He did not have enough evidence to figure out what had happened, and he had no further ideas on how to proceed. What's that store next to the playground? Laura asked. I think it's a convenience store, Paul replied. Can you talk to them? Maybe there's a security camera or something. Oh, brilliant. Paul navigated Detective Charleston into the store and spoke with the manager. Moments later, he was able to obtain the security camera footage from the time of the disappearance, which showed the boy being stuffed into a car with a clear license number. Back at his office, Detective Charleston ran the plate number and located the kidnapper. After the handcuffing scene, Paul was treated to a congratulatory message for having solved the case in level 3. And they waited. The house remained quiet, and it did not take long for Paul to become frustrated. He paced nervously around the living room. Where is he? I solved his case. Give it time, Paul. Remember, it took me several hours to make it back here after being released. Paul nodded, but it did not calm him. He stepped out onto the front porch for another cigarette and to watch for a boy come running toward him in the distance. When this didn't happen, he darted out into the middle of the front yard, gazed out into the darkness with his arms outstretched and yelled, "Give me my son back! Take me instead, you hear me? Come take me instead!" Dogs barked in the distance. Paul collapsed onto the lawn. And when he finally looked up, he saw Scotty moving toward him. He wasn't running, but walking slowly. He was reaching up with his left hand as if being led by a much taller adult, but Paul did not see anyone walking next to him. As Scotty approached, he could barely make out the vague outline of a tall, cloaked figure holding Scotty's hand. In a moment, Scotty was pulled into Paul's arms. The outlined figure stood over them. It wasn't translucent, but entirely solid, yet it took on the perfect semblance of the surroundings behind it. If Paul were to reach out and touch it, his hand would not pass through it, but meet resistance as real as any other body. It stood motionless and silent, and waited. Laura burst from the door and off the porch into the front yard.
Scotty!
She called to him.
Mama? It's me, baby. It's really me.
They hugged and wept together. Paul turned his attention toward the nearly indiscernible cloaked figure. It was at least 8 feet tall, and by his best estimation. Paul was kneeling when the figure's cloak parted at the bottom, revealing a blackness that could only be rivaled by the deepest, darkest cave. The entity stepped forward and absorbed Paul. The edges of the cloak reunited. And all was silent.
No!
Laura's scream was drawn out and ended with a hysterical wailing as she realized that only she and Scotty remained in the front yard. Somewhere in an inaccessible nether world, Paul slowly awoke in his fourth-story cage. He heard the wailing of all the other occupants in their cells, though he could not see them. On the wall in his small dark cage was a placard with two dates written on it. The first was the date of his imprisonment, and the second was the date exactly 1 year from then. Suddenly there was commotion below as a slightly overweight man was led by the cloaked figure onto the spotlit stage in the center of the arena below. The man was manacled to a post with a sinister-looking mechanical device positioned behind him. Paul had already closed his eyes by the time the machine was started up. He didn't want to see what it was or what was going to happen to the man. However, the screams he heard would never leave his mind. ...750 miles away from Paul Donovan's earthly home, a middle-aged man in a certain internet gaming circle known as 00Raven00 opened a padded envelope that had been sitting on his kitchen counter for several days. He inserted the plain disc into his gaming system and watched the opening sequence. Once he had control of the game, he opened the file folder on Detective Charleston's desk. A man named Paul had been pushed in front of a subway train by another person who then fled the station, according to the witness statements on trial. Being primarily an action-based gamer, Raven's patience wore thin quickly, and he spent only 15 minutes exploring for clues before giving up. "This game isn't even scary," he declared, and switched the system off.